Welcome back to the second hour of Guitar Tracks. I'm your host, Brian Tarquin. Tonight, I have a fantastic interview with the one and the only Stu Hamm. What an incredible bass player. He's played with Steve Vai, Joe Satriani, Frank Zappa. And so he starts out telling me he comes from a real musical family.
Oh, you know, I come from a family full of musicians. My dad was a well-known musicology and music history professor. And my mom was an opera singer, and my oldest brother played guitar. Then he moved to India and he plays sarod now. So my dad actually started the academic study of popular music. So we were exposed to everything from operas to classical music to pop music to jazz and avant-garde and a bunch of weird stuff. So I was playing music from a very early age. And then at that time, mid-70s was a great time for bass players. All the disco songs and R&B tunes and even, you know, Yes and some of the prog rock stuff had really prominent bass lines. And I just was attracted to the way the bass held everything together and the players that played a bit more melodically. And also where I grew up, they had a really world-class high school jazz band program, and I wanted to be in that. So I got my first, started playing upright bass about 1972, I guess. And then in 73 for Christmas, I got my first electric bass, and that was it for me. I mean, again, all the disco and R&B music of that era was bass driven. So just listening to the radio, you would hear funky and great bass lines. And then, you know, it was John Entwistle, The Who. And then I remember specifically hearing Roundabout for the first time. And the story is I got on my Stingray and drove to Kmart and spent some lawn cutting money to buy the album Fragile. And I saw a picture of Chris Squire with his cape and his freaking curly hair and his Rickenbacker. And I thought that was the coolest thing I'd ever seen in my life. So, and also when I was growing up, I looked a lot like Danny Bonaducci from the Partridge Family. And he was a red-haired pudgy geek that played bass. So he was another role model of mine. Born in New Orleans, but I lived in Italy, but I grew up mostly in Champaign, Illinois, which is the land of opportunity if you're a tractor.
Yeah, I would imagine that there's not much to do out there outside of farming. Now he goes on to tell me how his family moved to the East Coast, how he went to Berkeley, met Randy Coven and Steve Vai, and his world was changed.
When I was about 16, my family moved to Vermont. My father took over the music department at Dartmouth College. So I spent the last couple of years of high school up in the New Hampshire-Vermont border. Played a lot of gigs at that time. There weren't a whole lot of bass players up there. And then in 78, I went to Berkeley and I met a bunch of people who I spent the rest of my career playing with, including Steve Vai, who I met just maybe a month or two in going to Berkeley. And we had a band called Morning Thunder, and I played on his audition tapes for Zappa. And just met so many different musicians and bass players, and being able to fully commit to music 24/7 was just awesome. He was the most intimidating person in the world for me, because not only, you know, coming from Vermont, New Hampshire, where I was pretty cool, and then all of a sudden you come to Berkeley and there's all these bass players that can thumb slap and can play Teen Town. And then there's Randy, who's all that on top of his fucking Long Island attitude, you know, really aggressive shit, and just show up and with chops to destroy you. And you know, he wasn't a mellow, good-natured California dude, God rest his soul, but a great player. And sure, I know Randy, but he was originally, because he played with Steve, you know, back in the day, and he was just like, I was scared to death of the dude. Funk me tender, what can I say, right? You know, great bass player, you know. So what I recall is going to a party like in Brookline, and Steve was playing at somebody's house doing the national anthem. And I just sort of came up to him, and because I mean, once you see him, obviously everyone knew who he was. He used to play at practice room E16 at Berkeley. And I think, you know, Randy was there and all these dudes, and there was always a big crowd around. So obviously he's intimidating as shit, right? But I just walked up to him and said, hey, you know, I do my own version of that or something, introduced myself to him. And we began to play. And, you know, I maybe he liked some of the different musical influences that I had, you know, that he hadn't necessarily been you know, privy to. And then we just started playing, man. Like I said, we would rehearse. Used to be this thing at Berkeley. We'd have to get up. It's like 7 a.m. on Fridays and reserve the practice room for the week. And we'd always get E16. which is a big room, and there'd be just crowds of people watching around, and it was great. Yeah, awesome. And so from that, I played on his audition tapes, and then I moved to Germany for a little over a summer over there playing with a fusion big band, jazz rock big band over in Germany, and then flew back. He got me an audition for Zappa. So I learned, I used to cut the grass and mow and herbs vacation and all this stuff, and flew back to get back to Boston, and then flew to California, recorded with Frank for a couple of days. And he took Sunday off and said, "Hey, are you going to stick around and record some more?" And that Monday, I had tickets to see Miles Davis at Kix Disco in Boston, you know, with Mike Stern and freaking Marcus Miller and Al Foster. And I know some friends who knew, you know, the sax player. His name is Kate Smith, and the same name as the famous piano player. Bill Evans. And that was like the second gig he'd done in like a decade or whatever. And I saw Stern play all the time. And also I was playing with Michael Gibbs and his big band of Boston, and he had done some arranging for Miles and for, you know, Jaco and Mahavishnu and stuff like that. So he helped me get in there, and I may have blown the Zappa gig, but I got to see that incredibly memorable Miles gig. You know, it was unbelievable, man. Then I just like putzed around. I think I was on the road playing with Elvis Presley impersonator, and I got a call from Steve one day, and he said that he was, you know, going to record his own record. And I flew out to California and slept on the couch in his studio for about a year, and we did Flexible, and there it goes. From there, it went onward. It's so funny because part of what makes that record so incredible is sort of lost, I think, today, and the fact that, you know, it was done on a 4 or an 8 track, and Steve and everyone had to actually play that. You know, of course, you know, 5 years later than that, you have a Eventide where you can, you know, make it to sound, you know, like you're playing in parallel fifths or thirds or whatever, right? Or what a record attracts you. But he actually played all that shit, you know, physically, no Pro Tools. No moving stuff around a quarter beat if you don't like the groove. So it was great. You know, it was living in LA in those early days and just playing a bunch of bands and being a part of that scene. It is what it was, man.
Yeah, for those of you who are familiar with Steve Vai's Flexible album, the bass player is incredible, and that is Stu. He goes on to tell me about playing with Joe Satriani and how he developed his own bass style.
I've been already doing some solo bass gigs. Like this club called At My Place in Santa Monica, where a lot of people played, and got a little notice. So I approached the dudes, Cliff Cotrary, the guy that had signed Steve and eventually Joe to Relativity Records. I invited him to come down and see me play and, you know, convince them that they should give me some money to do a solo record. And so they gave me $5,000. And I quickly ran out of money. And so I needed, I needed someone to solo on a couple tunes, like 3 tunes. And Cliff said, "Hey, we just signed this new dude. He's a friend of Vi's. He's up in the Bay Area. His name's Joe Satriani. Why don't you play on the track on his? And, you know, he can play on your record. We'll fly you up there." So I said, "Great." So they flew me up to San Francisco, and I went to Hyde Street Studios when he was in the middle of doing Surfing with the Alien, and with the impetus of I was going to put a fretless bass line on Always. And then we just got to him recording the solos on Sexually Active and on, you know, Radio Free Albemuth and all that good stuff. And that's how I met. And then he just fell into some gigs at a few trade shows, you know, the NAMM show and the Hoshino event in Japan. And man, it just sort of evolved into that. And those were really good, interesting times. You know, it was great. I can't say I invented tapping on bass, of course, but just like I stole everything that I could from John Ebersole and then Chris Squire and then Stanley Clark and then Jaco, right? It just seems like a lot of what I got to first maybe is the cornerstone of just seemingly every modern bass player these days, right? So, I, you know, grew up playing piano, and there was a lot of piano music I liked, and hearing people, even though I came from, you know, the first thing I ever played on bass was like Killer Joe and reading jazz changes with a big band at an upright, right? So I'm firmly in the bass player tradition. And then there comes along Stanley Clark and Jeff Berlin and Jaco and Alfonso Johnson, the dudes that are playing a bit more melodically. And then on November 8th, 1978, when I had just been to Berkeley for about a month, someone handed me a ticket to go see Weather Report at the Orpheum Theater. And I'd known them from like the early avant-garde stuff with Miroslav, you know, that my brother listened to, I Sing the Body Electric and all that shit. But I'd never heard of Jaco yet. And so someone gave me a ticket and I went. And yeah, man, that was, Jaco was in the peak of his form, you know, especially compared to the times I saw him after that. And I just, you know, he just did what Hendrix did to all guitar players and changed everyone's idea about what could or could not be done on bass. So I went and I just tried to, you know, arrange some of the soul piano pieces I'd done for bass, like Gershwin's Prelude Number 2 and the Moonlight Sonata and stuff like that. And I guess, I mean, people, the story I tell is that, you know, I was playing with Vi and stuff and we would do Eruption, and, you know, those hammer-ons where you tap your finger down quickly become two words. You can just make the note sound with one hand by tapping down, which leaves the other hand free to do something completely different, right? And coming from a piano background, it wasn't that hard for me to develop independence between what the right and left hand were doing. And to give credit, I think Victor Bailey was the first dude I ever saw who sort of laid down a left hand ostinato and played a little melodically up on top, you know, tapping it. So and then it was just, man, back at the time I was just working it out. It took years and just ages and ages to figure out just the right fingering for that piece, and then beyond then to get control of it where I can phrase it and interpret it to make it sound like music. I mean, I've got pieces that I've been trying to work on since that era, since, like, you know, 1981, that I still can't play well enough to where I feel comfortable performing it in public, you know. So that was it, man. It was just a different way of trying to get more notes and more melody out of, you know, out of the bass. Called Linus and Lucy, that piece itself, the piece. Yeah, but it's contrapuntal. I remember thinking, like, well, when I had the idea to learn that piece, you know, man, if I could ever learn to play that, I'll have done it. I'll have accomplished it. And then when I learned to play it, it just opened up a whole new pathways, you know. But I think it's just difficult because I am a bass player, right? And, you know, you see now dudes with, you know, double-necked FM basses and guitars tapping. And, I mean, is that really a bass? I don't know, right? I love to play bass and groove. But I think one of the few times that I was able to integrate both techniques was when the first Satriani tours, when it was a trio, when we did Always, I would tap the bass line, you know, just with a B, B, E, F sharp. And then I could, with my right hand, I could tap the melody, but the arpeggios up top. And that worked because it had the low notes as well. If you're trying to go from playing a groove down on, you know, the root position, and then you go up to just tapping way up on the neck, like, the bottom is gone and the party's over as far as the music is concerned, right? So that was actually one of the few times that I got to use that with a Joe. And I think a lot of time people were exposed to that, and when I did the Vince Guaraldi during the solo. About 2 months into my career at Berklin 78, that I saw Jaco, and I finally said, hey, you know, maybe I could do, you know, more melodic, you know, treat the bass more like, you know, a piano, as far as being able to play contrapuntal things, now that I could get notes to sound out with one hand by tapping down, not having one hand fret it and one hand to pluck the string. So that gave me the impetus to really dive in and initially just try to learn a bunch of my piano staples that were everyone's piano staples back then. I mean, I remember reaching a point where I intentionally didn't want to watch Stanley Jordan or Billy play. I felt I was onto something and didn't want to be really influenced by what they do. And, you know, Stanley Jordan taps a whole different thing. And then what Billy does is somewhat connected to the way I tap, and what I do is connected to his, but he has a whole different, you know?
That's very true, because Stu really has his own unique bass style tapping. And though it may be similar to Billy Sheehan's, it is unique in its own way. Now Stu tells me about all his gear.
Love my original Fender jazz bass. And then I had a few other basses. I had a Padula fretless before they were Padula Orsini. I had an Alembic for a minute and blah, 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 blah. And then I was living in California and I picked up, back when Bass Player was a 10-page insert in Guitar Player magazine, and saw an ad for the Kubicki X Factor. And I just thought it was the second coolest thing I'd ever seen, next to Chris Squire with a cape and a Rickenbacker. So I think I was doing the NAMM show for Jackson with Vi, and I just kept circling around the Kubicki booth, and then finally got up the nerve to pick one up and started playing some of the stuff that I had known and maybe heard on bass before. And, you know, a little crowd gathered, and I started working with Kubicki people. And that was great in that it's a short scale bass, so it was easier to do some of the larger intervallic leaps that I'm doing. It's a lot harder to play that shit on a full scale bass as I get older now, right? But also, you know, just the sound of those kabukis, because there was such tension in the neck and the strings, you know, the brightness of it and the sustain of it really helped create that sound that I had back in those, in that era, and for the tapping. You know, the problem with the kabuki was that it's like an alembic, whereas, dude, I remember playing the Arsenio Hall show with David Beerwald, and the sound man said in my ear, says, hey, you know, hey, bass player, that sounds cool, but did you bring a bass? You know, it's like you bring an alembic to a country session or an R&B session. They're going to find you a P bass, you know, faster than you can say, you know, shoot me in Texas. So then when Fender started taking over the manufacturer of kabuki, you know, obviously I was sort of the focal point of that whole thing. And then I had the idea of creating a bass that took the best of the modern bass things and the classic form of a Fender. Would love to have had a bass that could sound like a P bass or a jazz bass and, you know, kabuki. So it was the first Fender bass with 24 frets and active electronics and the hip shot on there and everything. And since then, I've just loved designing different instruments, always hoping to do something new, you know, and fill a place in the marketplace, and working on some new things with a couple of different companies right now, and staring at a couple of my old Fender Urges, one and twos right now, and I still play them. And it's a great opportunity to be able to work with the manufacturers. I'm so fortunate to know people. Every time I get a new bass, I just drive up to Santa Rosa and have Rob Turner from EMG just freaking have his way with them. You know, so super fortunate to know these people, you know, that cultivated and worked on cultivating those relationships in my freaking 50 years of playing bass, right? Joe, of course, hated the sound of the kabuki. You know, he always just wanted a dude to play a P bass with a pick and double his guitar parts. You know, this was the 80s, the land of excess, right? Where you just couldn't have more is not enough, right? So let's have three pickups on a bass, not just a P and a J, but a third pickup. And so I had one of my kabukis, and I had Fender put a P bass in the middle of it between the two kabuki pickups, just so it could get more of the sound that's, you know, that the artist wants, that my employer wants, and that would fit that style of music, right? And that morphed into what we did on the Fender Urge. And I think some of the original ones just had bass and mid-range, but bass and treble, but the mid-range is obviously important, because that's sort of, you know, the cornerstone of all post-Jackal players is where you're going to put that mid-range. You know, it was with Warwick. They had really wonderful basses, man. This guy Marcus Spangler, who's no longer with them, but hand-built the first few prototypes. Yeah, I mean, those were sort of my go-to basses. Now, again, I'm staring at my rack now, and it's got, you know, a Fender Urge 1, strung as a piccolo, one of my Fender Urge 2 fretlesses, my sparkly red Fender Urge. It's got three Warwicks, two prototypes for the Stuham model and one Stuham model, and a Dingwall that I did some surgery to, and a Madison bass that I'm currently destroying and reimagining with the True Temperament system on it. So those are that's what's in the rack that I'm staring at right now that I switch between. They just make, man, Warwick, they make wonderful, wonderful, wonderful basses. And then every bass I get, again, what I have Rob and Tommy Armstrong, you know, hook me up with what they know I like pickup wise and string it with GHS boomers, then it sort of evens out, you know, how I can create my sound. I had my first active pickups. EMG's putting my bass at EU Wurlitzers in Boston in like 1980. So I've been an active electronic solid state Class D amp guy forever. You know, it gets a little more, I don't know, clarity. And, you know, dude, I mean, I know, especially in LA, a whole slew of dudes, Rudy Sarzo and all those dudes who can make an Ampeg, you know, 8x10 sound great. When I play through an Ampeg, it just sounds like cardboard, and I literally ruin my shoulder trying to play too hard to get some sort of sound that isn't there, right? So I know how to work that sound, right? I just can't get my thing going on with the warmth and the lack of focus of the tone of a tube amp. I designed an amp with Mark Bass that has a solid state and a tube preamp. So again, trying to have one thing that can do it all, so that, you know, I've got the solid state amp, I'm doing my thing. If I'm doing sessions or, you know, a gig where it needs that more rounder, fuller tone, then I have it right there. And they're everywhere. They're ubiquitous, right? So if I'm doing fly dates and I know them so well that as long as they have some sort of Mark bass amp there, I know how to EQ it to be able to get my tone out of it. I designed a signature head and this K cabinet with these really lightweight 215s that has a lot of clarity. So obviously that's when I have that, it's golden. And like, you know, especially when I'm going to Europe, the mark base is right there in Italy. So they've arranged, you know, a rig for me to carry on with me. And they're really good about having it there. You know? So I'm getting old, man. If I don't have the right gear, it just hurts to play, man.
Yeah, I can attest to that. You really need the right gear to get that tone and that sound, or it's going to be a real workout. Now he goes on to tell me about his last record, Hold Fast, and his new projects coming up.
Well, you know, I just had one released that was Hold Fast, and it's a super prog rock record. It's got Gergo Borlai and Joel Taylor on drums and my buddy Alex Skolnick on guitar. And Randy McStein on guitar and singing a few songs. And it's super good. And I had Javier Reyes from Animals as Leaders co-produce it and help me mix it just to get a bit more modern sound. And it's big and beefy and sounds great. Bubby Lewis plays guest on a few tracks. And check it out. It's awesome. Awesome. This post-pandemic state of clubs and stuff and the fact that I do play a style of music that, you know, quote Spinal Tap, again, appeals to a very selective audience, right? The economics of being able to go out and bass-led, ambient jazz rock fusion, intelligent music could draw, you know, 750 people a night. I'd be set, right? You know, that's a tough thing to do. Tough thing to do. Victor could do it. You know, the Stanley and Marcus, you know, like going on the Legends. You know, you got younger guys like Maranian. I see he's out there doing dates and, you know, Charles Bertaud, this, you know, this whole thing. So there's just other ways around it. But I play around town with my band, Big Kato, every few months and tour with Alex every now and then. But I am just headed next week, actually, a week from tomorrow, over to Europe to do a month of dates with Chad Wackerman on drums and Michael E. Ferkins on guitar. We're doing a tribute to Jeff Beck's music. So rearranging, but being faithful to, you know, Jeff Beck music. And it'll be great to just play every night and play some of the same clubs I've played a million times and see a bunch of familiar faces. I guess it's really the first time I've been to Europe since the pandemic. I was on tour with my band on whatever March, you know, 10th or wherever it was that in Denmark when, you know, Trump went on TV and said they're shutting the borders and everyone flew home. And I don't think I've been to Europe since then. Well, I mean, besides my I also run a bass camp of my own, the Estonian Bass Oasis. This will be the third year that we're doing that in the fall. That's been great. I've had Mohini Day and Chris Mendilke and Alex and Gergo and Dennis Chambers coming this year. So chance for bass players to get together and play with really good musicians, different styles. You know, they get to play funk with Dennis Chambers and Bobby Lewis this year. And it's a cool hang in an absolutely beautiful part of the world. So do that. But looking forward to get out And then my next record I'm working on, man, I'm working with this producer named Roger Greenwalt, and I've been threatening to do an ambient record for a while because I listen to a lot of ambient music and weirdly tuned piano music. So I'm going to do something totally uncommercial. I don't think anyone's tried to commit career suicide more often than I, but it's what I feel the need to do. And I've been working with like Pigtronix and David Coltai, and I got a bunch of, you know, cool sounds. I just have some ideas for different ways of using loopers and stuff to just create, you know, some out of time stuff. And just, I don't know, that's something I've wanted to do. So I think that's what I'm going to do next. And from there, we'll just see what happens.
Now, we are all looking forward to some new Stu Hamm music. In fact, I'm going to be working with him on a new track with Joe Satriani. So here is the title song from his new album, Hold Fast. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Hi, this is Stu Hamm, and you listen to Guitar Tracks on WFIT, the best in instrumental music.
Gotta love that. Salamanders in the Sun. Steve Vai, Flexible, featuring Stu Hamm on bass. What a classic track. Before that was Tales of My Midwestern Youth by Stu Hamm from his new album, Hold Fast.